that effect on everyone. Okay, first let me get through with the thank yous, because if I don't do this, I always forget, and then I'm mad at myself forever. So I would like to thank Rex and David, our chair and co-chair of this wonderful roundup. It's a lot of work. And all of the committee members, thank you so much for all that you do. I appreciate it, and I'm sure everyone else does here, too. And my lovely hostess, Penny, who's terrified to be sitting up here. Send her some love. And I have lovely gifts I have in my room. They called me up and asked me what I wanted, and that's what they gave me. It was really cool. What a wonderful idea. That was just great. So, okay, and let's see what else. Oh, I want to thank Roger and the tapers. I wouldn't be here without tapes. I lived on them for years. So, okay, I'm ready now. Hi, my name's Cookie, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the 12-step program of recovery from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since October 25th, 1983. I don't know if that impresses you, but it impresses the heck out of me. Okay, I'm getting here. Really, I am. You know, it was really funny one time. I was going to do one of my first talks, and I called my sponsor, and I said, I really want to carry the message, and I want to do a good job, and I want to tell them that God is, and I want them to know that they never have to drink again, and I really want to do a good job. And she said, well, Cookie, you were at that roundup last year. Do you remember the speakers? And I said, well, was one of them a woman? And she said to me, well, that's about how many people are going to remember you, so don't worry about it. So then the other thing I always worry about, because I've gained a bunch of weight, and so I'm standing up here and I'm thinking, oh, what am I going to wear? I just haven't got anything to wear right now. And then I realized that most of you only see me from about here up. Okay, I was born a rich white child, and from that, and I love to talk about this part of my story because it's very different from a lot of speakers, and because that's different does not make me different, it's just that my lifestyle was different. I was brought up in a family who loved and cared for me. I was told I could accomplish anything I ever wanted to accomplish. I have an older brother and a younger brother, and I was the middle kid, and I was a super achiever. I wanted to be the good girl. I wanted to grow up to be just like my mom. My mom's a lady, and I wanted to be a lady just like my mom. And so all of those things you don't hear about a lot, people telling their stories in AA. But the one thing I do know today is that alcoholism is an equal opportunity destroyer, and it doesn't really care where you came from or how much money you have or don't have or if you're black or white or Catholic or Jewish or Buddhist, or if you have the illness of alcoholism like I have the illness of alcoholism, you get to die of the same disease or you get to recover together with us. So we're here tonight, and this is our night, and I'm so glad you're here. Makes my day. So, okay, I started out, and I remembered one time I was talking to my girlfriend, and we were both about 2 years sober, and we went back and we decided we'd think about when was the first time that alcohol affected you? You know, I mean, not necessarily when you drank, but when did alcohol affect you? You know, and I had to think about it for a while, and, you know, I was thinking about it, and I went, And then all of a sudden I remembered when I was young, my parents used to have these wonderful parties, and they were like balls, and people would come dressed up, and that's when people actually used to all get dressed up to go to a party, and so they would come dressed up, and they would be beautiful, and the men would come in tuxedos, and the women would come in long dresses, and they would just all look so sophisticated, and I had to go around and curtsy and meet every one of them, and I passed hors d'oeuvres and curtsied and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, I just watched all of it, and it gone on for, you know, weeks beforehand to make the house look right, and it was just all that kind of exciting atmosphere around the house, and so I was there that night, and I saw everybody coming, start to come in, and my mom had this gorgeous dress, and I had my little goofy outfit on, and I've never been much of a girly girl. So I kind of think some of those are like goofy outfits because my mother liked to dress me up like a real girly girl, and I usually made a big mess out of it in no time. But, okay, so this lady came in, and she was You know how some people are just more than other people? They're just more, you know? And she came in and she was more. She walked in the door and she had on this blue gown, and it started up here and it was blue sequins. And it started light blue and it was only on one shoulder. Woo, racy. And it's up here and went down and down and down and down. And it was a form-fitting outfit and she had a form to fit. And it went down and down and down and down, and it pooled around the bottom of her feet in this blue pool. And she was just gorgeous. You know, and she had this great big huge hairdo. I still suffer from that. And higher the hair, the closer you are to God. And I watched her, you know, and she had these little blue shoes and a little blue bag that hung off of her thing. And she had this gorgeous husband. He was in a tuxedo. He was so handsome. I have always been a fool for men in tuxedos. I have got to quit marrying them. Glad there are none here. I'm single again. So I couldn't. And everybody watched them. And she had this big long cigarette holder. And on the end of the cigarette, everybody smoked back then. And on the end of the cigarette holder, she had little blue rhinestones. They matched her dress. I was so impressed. You know. And the butler came by and asked her if she'd like to have anything to drink. And she said, I'll have a martini. Just like that, I'll have a martini. I've been practicing it for years. I'm not much of a girly girl. Okay, so the butler came back, and here was a V-shaped martini glass, and he got her one with little blue bulbs on the bottom. Oh, my. How impressive. And so she stood there drinking her drink with her cigarette, and she'd throw her head back and go, ha, 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 and all the men were around her. And I wanted what she had. Attention. That's why I love it. I live in a suburb called Edina. And Edina stands for Every Day I Need Attention. So anyway, she was just gorgeous, and she had her martini and her drink, and you know, everybody was milling around, and her husband was talking to other people and other people. And then my mother dismissed me for the evening. I had to go say goodnight to everybody. And so I went around and said goodnight to everybody, and I went upstairs and sort of hid so I could watch everybody down there. And being the good budding alcoholic that I was fascinated by this. And so it was a lot later, and pretty soon she was standing there, and she was talking to some people, and now her cigarette's kind of going over here. And her martini's kind of going over here. And even her hair sort of. And her husband was standing there, and all of a sudden, he just swooped her up and took her out the door. And I thought, oh, isn't that romantic? I didn't know she'd passed out. So I heard my father talking to my mother the next day. And he said, you know, dear, Mrs. So-and-so is really quite a nice, lovely lady, but when she drinks too much, she becomes a bit of a floozy. I didn't know what a floozy was. It was about a month later, my father asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I said, a floozy. I'm here to tell you I achieved my goal. Oh, bad joke on Cookie. But yeah, add alcohol instant floozy. Okay. So when I turned 13, my girlfriend and I got together, and her parents were out of town for the weekend, and I decided to make my, we broke into the liquor cabinet, the first of my illustrious career, and we broke into the liquor cabinet, and I had gone out and I had purloined a cigarette holder. My sponsor pointed out to me in my fifth step that purloined is a fancy word for theft, Cookie. Rats. So I had found this cigarette holder, and I also had a cigarette that I found shortly before somebody lost it, and you can imagine how much fun I was to sponsor in the beginning, can't you? And, So I decided to make myself a... Oh, you guys have been paying attention. You've heard me before, girl. Yeah, I decided to make myself a martini. Now, I don't know about you, but I have looked back upon this over the years, and I realized something. Did I think I was an alcoholic before I took a drink? You know, because I started obsessing about this from the moment of that party until the time I could drink that first drink. Isn't that amazing? You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about the fact that we have an obsession of the mind. And I hadn't even introduced alcohol to it yet. So, you know, I poured that drink, and I knew there was no ice in it, because there wasn't any ice in her pretty glass, and so I poured myself a glass full of warm gin. And that's a good starter drink, don't you think? And right into the big time. And I lit my cigarette with my ratty little cigarette holder. And, you know, good starter drink, don't you think? And right into the big time. And I lit my cigarette with my ratty little cigarette holder. And, you know, Clancy, I don't know if I'm sure most of you know who Clancy is. He's a speaker. And he talks about alcoholism, and he's got a tape called The Disease of Perception. And I've thought about that many times over the years, and when he talks about that disease of perception, he talks about that alcoholics see things differently than other people do, and I totally believe that today. And, you know, here I am, I'm sitting there, I'm 13 years old, and I got a blue shirt, big surprise, right? And my blue jeans, which at that time we were wearing elephant bells, and I'm really old, and now they're back, that's how old I am. And and I had a... poured myself this glass full of gin, and I was going to take this drink. And now before that liquor ever hit my lips, I had turned into that beautiful lady in that blue dress before I took the first drink. It was amazing to me, just amazing to me when I look back. It took me a long time to put all this together. But I took that first drink, and, you know, I love the big book because it says something. It says when alcoholics drink, something happens. How about you? Did something happen when you drank? It talks about the fact that men and women drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol, and the effect is so elusive that after a while we cannot differentiate the true from the false. To us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I pick up that drink, I start to drink it, and something happened. And what happened for me is ever since I was a small child, I had something that went on in my head. I was very gifted athletically, and I did a lot of stuff. And I wanted to be a winner. I always wanted to be a winner. And here's why. I would sit when I'd watch people and do things, and my head would say this to me. Now, I don't know if you've ever realized your head talks to you. You know, you may not know that you can talk back to it yet. But anyway, so I'm talking, my head is just talking at me. It says things like this. You know, Cookie, no matter how hard you try, no matter how good you do, you're never going to be just quite good enough. You're never going to be good enough. You've got to work harder and try harder than everybody else because you're not going to be good enough. You know that you're too tall, too short, too fat, too thin. You know that there's something wrong with you. There's just something wrong with you. You know it's not quite good enough. You better work harder. You better try harder. You're just not good enough. This was constant with me, and it kept me going. It kept me performing in all my sports. It drove me all the time. And I took that drink of alcohol. In a matter of about 3.5 minutes, it was gone. And I don't know about you, but I loved the fact that it was gone. And that's the effect alcohol had on me. And I'm going to tell you, I was willing to chase that to the gates of insanity and death. That one feeling that first time that I got. You know, but I did then what I do almost every time I drink. I sort of overshot the mark. And every time I've had as much alcohol as I want to drink, I drank until I got drunk and passed out and threw up. In any order. Whichever you like. And that's what happened that night. And I remember decorating the bathroom. And I just thought that this was the most wonderful thing in the entire world. And why hadn't I found it before this? Now, I have gone from, in a very about 3 hours of time, from this little girl who wanted to be like her mom and be a lady to someone who's got to figure out how to drink better so they don't throw up. This is not normal. I know it's normal to most of you. It's not normal. And so I remember that so clearly. And the effect alcohol had on me was that I was free. I was free, finally. In a matter of 2 years, every single one of my sports was gone. I dropped out of high school. I just wanted to drink, thank you very much. I started out drinking, and when I started drinking, I couldn't stop drinking. It was never any different. I was an alcoholic from the get-go. I just had to plan it better and try harder. I was, like I said, I was brought up with very privileged surroundings, and so I didn't find it difficult at all to get all the liquor I ever wanted. I just blackmailed the maid. No hobby. And so, you know, I was going along, and I was doing all this stuff, and my life is totally revolving now around alcohol. And I was—I had gone out to California to visit my cousin, and while I was out in California, I fell in love. And I'm all of 19 years old, you know, 18 years old, and I fell in love. And I came back, and he came back to my family, and I was going back out east to meet his family. And he was back in California; he was going to be a marine biologist, and we were going to move to Hawaii and get married. And he was driving back from surfing one day, and the axle broke in his Jeep, and he was thrown from the Jeep, and he was brain dead. From that moment to this moment today, I would turn off anything that had anything to do with emotion. That devastated me to such a point that I didn't even know what to do with it. I had never had any bad news in my life. My life and my family, it was always fun. It was always funny. It was always do the fun stuff. And all of a sudden, I didn't know what to do. And so I did what I usually did. I drank a lot. And I was hanging out with my girlfriend. I was thinking about what I was going to do with my life since I was now a high school dropout, and I decided to go to college. Why not? And it's not too hard to do, actually. And so I was getting ready to go off east to college. I wanted to go to broadcasting school. At that time, there were no women in broadcasting. And so I thought, this would be a great position for me. You know, you can rise really fast. It'll be really cool. It'll all be fun. And so that's what I did. I was getting thin. I was hanging out with my girlfriend, Chris. Every time I wanted to get thin, I'd hang out with Chris, and Chris was about 6'2" and weighed 7 pounds, and she was great to hang out with, and she had a lot of hair, blonde hair, and she was one of those really annoying people that could lay out 90-degree heat in a full set of makeup and never perspire, you know, and she'd lay out in this perfect, and I'm a tomboy, so we'd go out together, and she'd lay in this perfect lawn chair position with her little pink bikini on, and I'm out in a swimming suit, swimming laps, you know, and I'd come back and look at her, and I'd take a drink of my beer and go back out, and pretty soon I saw this XKE drive by, and I'm a car freak, so I see this car drive by, and drives by 7 times, so I think, well, ha, this is interesting, so I figure he's looking at Chris, you know, I'm looking like a drowned rat. And he walks down, and he walks right up to me. He walks into the water. And I said, I just looked at him, and he said, gee, you look refreshing. I said, you want a beer? It was about a month and a half later, I decided I was going to marry him. My mom was real happy about that. I think it was the third date, actually. And I have always wanted to remind myself of this because it's some of my really clever and wonderful thinking because I'm ever so bright. And I have to remind myself of how bright I am every once in a while just so I can bask in the glow of my Duraflame log. I'm standing there and I'm thinking about all this and I'm thinking back when I'm thinking about this and I think, why did I marry him? And I had 2 reasons. One was he never said anything about my drinking. Guess why? I promised my sponsor I wouldn't take his inventory from the podium. But suffice it to say that he's been in 17 treatment facilities. And the second reason was because he asked. Sad part about that is I married the second one, sobriety, for the same reason. Oh, golly. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But, yeah. And we started off, and we were quite the couple. We were both tall, dark, and handsome. And I had an ability, and he had an ability to make a great deal of money at that time. And I'd started my own company when I was 20 years old, and through the grace of God and this fellowship of this program and a lot of very good luck and a lot of very loving friends, I retired from that business with 35 years just last year. So I started my business then, and I was in a field where there were no women, of course. And because, you know how we are about other women. I don't know about you women out there, but I'm sort of that way about other women. You know, I mean, I don't really want to be around them because most women don't drink like I drink, and they always tend to notice. Like, they see things like, are you having another? Haven't you already had two? Yeah, I'm warming up. So, I don't know about you, but I eliminated friends who didn't drink like I drank. They just sort of got pushed to the sides. And so we started living a very fancy lifestyle. And we had fancy cars and fancy things, and everything was fancy. And I hung around with some pretty important people. And I traveled all over the world, and I did a lot of fancy stuff. My husband used to travel on the road Mondays through Fridays, and we had a nice little five-bedroom house for the two of us. And he was gone. My girlfriend lived upstairs. You never knew she lived up there. It was great. I loved hanging around with her because she was slowly working her way through an entire football team. It was kind of like a spectator sport. And so, you know, she'd be off with all these football players all the time. And I go out drinking with her because I just wanted somebody to drink with and go out and have fun. And I have to give you a picture of what I looked like at that time. For some of you that are young enough, you may not remember any of this. Or you may have seen it on old movies. I had two sets of wigs. My hair was about out to here. And I wore two sets of eyelashes up here and one set down here. And I had white go-go boots, platform go-go boots, that came up over my knee and folded over. They were vinyl. They were really sexy. And then I wore a little hot pants. Everybody remember hot pants? I had my little hot pants. You know, and then that was when we wore that real light lipstick, you know, and then we had the white and the brown and the white, and we drew the little twiggies under our eyes. I was just gorgeous. And so I would hang out with her, and she would be working her way through the team, and I'd be watching this, and it was great fun. And I'd hang out with all of them, I like to sort of lip off a little. I know you find that hard to believe. But I would make jokes with these guys and have fun and all kinds of stuff, And I was a little girl that really lived in the suburbs and had been very sheltered all of her life. I had parents who loved me. I didn't know there were bad things that went on in this world. I really didn't. That was someplace over there. It didn't make any sense to me. And it was a different world then. And so I was kind of laughing with these guys. And one of the guys was kind of rather slow. And I'd tell jokes. And he'd come up and go, "Hey, I got that cookie." And I could say things like, "Good in this millennium." And, you know, and I was not nice. And so this is not any to give any kind of an idea or reason for anything. It's just this fact that set this thing up. And so I came home one night, and unbeknownst to me, he followed me home. And I was home for about 15 minutes, and he came to my door, and I said, "What are you doing here?" And he got himself in, and he ended up raping me. Now, this happened in my own home, and I had no system in place to deal with what happened to me. None. I was sober for a number of years before I could even talk about this. And it was hard. I blamed myself. I thought if I had just not said that stuff, if I just had not worn that outfit, if I just had not. And I didn't know. I didn't know anything. And I carried that shame with me. And it was to light the rest of my behavior for the rest of my drinking. There's something I want to say to you if that's been your experience, and I do know that for the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, only over 85% of us come in here with some sort of form of abuse. And I want to hear you if you're out there and this has happened to you. I want you to hear me. It is not your fault. It is not your fault. No matter what happened, no matter what you wore, no matter what you said, no matter anything, nobody, absolutely nobody, has the right to hurt you, to downgrade you, to rape you, to hit you, or anything else. Nobody has that right. I carried that shame for so long and so hard. It was shortly after the next day I woke up and I didn't know what to do with this. I had no idea what to do with this. You know, I was this happy-go-lucky kid that I wasn't even an adult yet, really. And I tried to commit suicide because I figured I was damaged goods. This doesn't happen to good girls. This doesn't happen to girls that live like I live and grow up where I grow up. There's something very wrong with me, and now I know it. And I remember I took all the pills I had at the time. They weren't good enough pills. Obviously, I'm not very good at suicide. So, but I woke up, and I was mad. I was real mad. I was mad at the fact that that I had not killed myself. I thought I was a loser because I couldn't even kill myself right. And the thing about that is when I woke up, my husband was there, and I didn't know what to say to him. And, you know, we're amazing people for alcoholics, and if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, you might relate to the fact that we know how to rally. And, you know, one of the things I did was I just sat there, and I didn't know what to do. But from that moment on until the moment, until I was close to 2 years sober, I could not look in the mirror and look myself in the eye. I'd look at whatever piece of me I was putting makeup on. I'd look all over like that, but I could never look at myself again. And I didn't know that I had let somebody steal my soul. I didn't know that. So what I decided to do was I've got to get this together, Cookie. This is ridiculous. You've got to get this together. You've always been good at everything. You can win at everything. Get yourself together. And I rallied. You know, I rallied and I said, this is it. I'm not going to think about that anymore. I have always lived from that day until I did my fifth step with the Scarlett O'Hara theory of living, which is I won't think about that today. I'll think about that tomorrow when I'm in Terra. So, you know, I just threw things back here, and I didn't think about them anymore, and I was going to rally, and I was going to be that person, you know, that just gets out there, and I'm going to do the right thing, and I'm going to be this right person. And so I stopped drinking, and I stopped smoking, and I stopped doing everything, and I went to work, and I did my job, and I came home every night, and I did needlepoint in front of TV. I'm not drinking. I'm not going to drink. I'm not drinking tonight. I'm not drinking tonight. I'm not drinking tonight. I'm not drinking. I am not going to drink tonight. I did this for 30 days. You think I don't have willpower? Yikes. You know, and that's the interesting thing about alcoholism. You know, I'm sitting there and I'm doing that, but what am I doing? I'm thinking about drinking what I'm not drinking. You know, and that's what they talk about, the mental obsession. I have never had a problem with the second step in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never. Because I can sit there and my insanity says this time it's going to be different. It took me 30 days, and in 30 days, you know what happened? I'm sitting there one night after those 30 days had passed and everything's going cool, and I said to myself, well, you know, I've been sober for 30 days. This time it'll be different. It was. If you know anything about alcoholism, it gets very different. It gets worse, in case you didn't know. So don't go back out there again. Anyway, I, you know, it did get worse, and I started drinking. I had vengeance for drinking. Now, I didn't really care. I didn't care much about anything. I didn't care about you, and I didn't care about what happened to me, and I didn't care about anything because I figured nothing, absolutely nothing, is going to stand in my way of doing whatever I feel like doing from now on. I've always tried to follow the rules. I always tried to be a good girl. I always tried to, you know, grow up just like my mom and be a lady. What good has it done me? You know, and I gave up on myself, and that's the problem with women when we go through these things. We throw ourselves away, and if you throw yourself away, I want to hear you something. I want you to hear something that I'm saying. We have 12 steps here, and two of them are 4 and 5. And in 4 and 5, you get free. You get free. You know, the steps are like an inside shower. You're the person that's going to get free. So we went around. It got even crazier after that, and my husband came home one day and said, you know, I bought a boat, and I thought, oh, good, for the lake. And he said, no, we're going to move to Acapulco and live on a yacht. And I thought, did I miss, like, 6 months of this marriage or something? And which wouldn't have been surprising at that point. But, yeah, and then, I mean, he just thought these things up, and he would say, you know, and I've sold the house. Really? Where am I going to live now? You know? And, but I didn't care because, you know what, at this point I didn't care anything about anything. I didn't care about what I did or who I did it with, and I didn't care when I did it. And what I would do is I'd go out and I'd go drinking with my friends, and I'd pick your boyfriend, your husband, or any other person that would say hello to me. And I'd just sort of walk away with you, you know, and I just wanted somebody to drink with me. I wanted someone to drink with me and to play with me and to pay attention to me because my husband never did. He was too busy working. I just love the way we ration things. Anyway, so there I am, and I'm doing all this crazy stuff, and I'm going everywhere, and I'm doing all whatever. I'm living. We had, at that time, we had a house in Florida and a house in Minnesota, and we had a jet to drive, go back and forth with. We had a couple of yachts, and I drove a Ferrari and a Porsche. I had everything in the world I've ever wanted. Everything. Everything. And this is a bad place to be if you're an alcoholic, because, you know, it's always that thing that says, you know, well, if I only had that, it would all be okay. I had that and that and that and that and that and that. So, you know, I'm really grateful for that today because I know something that's coming back to give me a second chance of learning it, which is if my life depends upon the car I drive or the watch I wear or anything else, I'm in big trouble. If my life depends upon anything you think of me, I'm in big trouble. You know? The thing that brought me here was I had been out working one night, and I got was coming back from a job, and drunk ran through a red light and hit me. And I spent the next 2 years in hospitals, pretty much destroyed my back and a lot of other parts of me. And so I I just became a recluse. They gave me lots of drugs. I needed lots of drugs to get along with things, you know, and I'd go to my doctor and I'd say, I can't sleep, and so he'd give me sleeping pills, and I'd say, I'm in so much pain, I can't stand it. He'd give me painkillers. And then I said, I'm really depressed, and so he'd give me antidepressants. And then I said, you know what, my muscles are in constant stress. He gave me muscle relaxers. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because I was doing all that and drinking a quart of booze a day. I didn't move a lot. You know, and I became that recluse person you hear about, the one that's all by themselves, all alone. And that's who I was. I'm sitting in this wonderful morass of self-pity, and I don't know what to do with myself anymore. I don't know what day it is, and I don't care what day it is. I'm very, very large. I'm an attractive shade of yellow, and I'm dying of the disease of alcoholism, and I don't know I'm an alcoholic. I don't know anything about the mental obsession. I don't know anything about the physical compulsion of alcoholism. I don't know I have an allergy to alcohol. All I know is that that stuff makes me feel okay. Please don't ever take it away. And I'm now in the position where my body's shutting down from alcohol and I'm curling across my $40,000 Persian rug to go into the kitchen to shinny myself up on a cabinet so that I can drink and throw up and drink and throw up and drink and throw up and drink and throw up. And maybe the fifth or the sixth or the seventh one will stay down. I am now a chronic alcoholic and I'm living on a skid row. It's a very fancy skid row, but it was skid row for me. And there was nothing left of Cookie. I was gone. All I wanted to do is to just die. That's all I wanted to do. I had been beaten into a state of reasonableness by alcoholism, and I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I was living this life. My husband was doing really crazy stuff, and it was just like a circus, you know. And I've heard many people say that if you marry an alcoholic and you live in an alcoholic marriage, you got a dance of death, and that's what we had, was a dance of death. I decided I was finally going to kill myself. This time I was going to make it for sure. And I had lots of good pills now. And I remember looking up, and it was a gray day. And it was right about now. And I was looking out of the window, and I was looking up, and I said one thing. And I said, God, if there is a God. Now, I'm going to tell you, it had been a long time since this Cookie had talked to any kind of God. Because I didn't figure he wanted to have much to do with me with all the things that had happened to me. I had too much shame. I said, God, if there is a God, please, this time let me die. I don't want to do this anymore. Don't make me do this anymore, please. Now, I don't know what your third step sounded like, but I think that qualified me. It was interesting because I was going to take all those drugs and the doorbell rang. You know how annoying it is when somebody interrupts your perfectly good suicide plan? I mean, really? How rude. So I can't believe I opened the door to this day, but, you know, that's what I did. And it was my father, and we do not have a drop-in family. We're a very formal group. Usually if my father was going to come over, he'd call and say he was going to come over. So here's my dad standing there. I said, Daddy, what are you doing here? And he said, Honey, I've come to take you home. I can't watch this anymore. And I said, Okay. And I left. And I left everything. The cars and the yachts and the planes and everything. I just left. Well, I took my makeup. It's hard to cover up that much yellow. Anyway, so at this point I had no clothes because I'd been living in this really lovely kind of horrible chenille bathrobe that was all had cigarette burns all down the front and dribbly stuff. And it was all funny in the front because I kept crawling everywhere in it. I was really attractive, and I had decided a couple times to perm my own hair and color it so it was straight out like this and frizzed to death and black, you know, and I was not looking pretty, okay, and I'm yellow, and I just remember walking out the door, and it was quite a few years later, I remember what I said to myself, and what I said to myself is one of us is going to survive this, and it's going to be me. I don't know when you made your decision or if you've made your decision yet. But I knew something right then, and I knew it was never going to be the same, ever, that everything was going to change. My parents, I came home to my parents, and my mother had to lend me a dress because I didn't have anything to wear, so she found this lovely muumuu. I still think of this. And so we had to go see an old friend of theirs, and so I put on this muumuu, and I tried to cover up as much of the yellow as I could. It's kind of hard to kind of get your eyeballs looking right, though. And so, you know, and I wasn't really good at putting my makeup on, so I didn't really put much on, but I kind of got it together. And we go out to this place, and it was a place where I'd grown up in, and their house and their home and these people, and I hadn't seen any of these people in years. I'd become, like I said, a recluse. And so we came there, and they said, well, make yourself a drink cookie. My parents have never understood alcoholism. I don't think they ever really will understand alcoholism. It is not their job to understand alcoholism. It's my job to understand them. And so, you know, I made myself a drink. You know, one of those drinks we make ourselves. You know those drinks. You know, glass, rum. Fill glass, put in a ice cube. Ah, perfect. So I had now gotten to the point that I would throw up all the time before something would stay down, so I was kind of wondering whether this one was going to stay down or not. And it did, thank God. And I made myself another one. That one didn't feel like it. So I, my parents said we were going to go home, and so I thanked the hostess for inviting me on short notice. It was very lovely to see her again. And I went out, and I walked down the way to my parents' car, and I walked around my parents' car, and they were still talking to this Mrs. Jones. And so I threw up in the bushes. Now, I had been raped. I have had a lot of stuff happen to me. This certainly wasn't the highlight of my drinking career, but it's the thing that got my attention. And I hope you always remember the one that gets your attention. Because the real strength in being us, and me sharing with you and you sharing with me, is when we remember who we are, so we never forget who we are. And as we drove away, I said to myself, so this is the lady you've become, Cookie. You throw up in bushes. And at that moment, I knew my problem was alcohol. I think the hand of that God that I hadn't anything to do with for an awful lot of years came and took me away and said, it's okay, honey. And he started making things clear to me. And I knew from that moment on that I could never drink again. Now, that was not something I thought up on my own, trust me. And so I did that, and I remember my parents had a friend that owned a treatment facility, so they sent me to the treatment facility. You know, it's nice having money. And I went there, and the lady interviewed me, and one of the people that was a secretary there today, I still see in my Friday meeting, and she always looks at me and goes, you're such a miracle. But it's wonderful to have friends for, you know, 22 years that have seen you come all the way. That's one of the gifts of sobriety. But yeah, I went to treatment, and I just, you know, they did this interview, and I said, what do you feel like? And I said, I feel like I'm in the inside of a stainless steel drum that's got a cone at the bottom, and I'm going around and around in a whirlpool, and I'm going to slide down, and I'm going to be dead. And he said, we have a chair for you. But for me, you see, once I start drinking, I can't stop drinking. I never could, and I didn't even want to. Didn't even want to. Never. I never went out and said, let's have two drinks. I was not of that variety. I was an alcoholic from the get-go, instant drunk. I got to explain this. Let me tell you this one. My mother, who is just an adorable woman, and she's 83 years old now, and she's just a kick in the pants. And I remember I was about 14 years sober, and every once in a while she'd say something like, was it because we made you skate too much when you were young, honey? Maybe you shouldn't have had to have those horses to ride. You always had to be doing something. Maybe we shouldn't have done that for you. You sure it wasn't because we went up north every year? And I said, Mom, okay, let me do this one more time. Alcoholism is an equal opportunity disease. It doesn't care if you're rich or poor. I was the lucky genetic winner of alcoholism in our family. And today I believe I am the lucky genetic winner in our family because I have a way of living that outshines anything else I've ever had. But I said to her, you know, it's a genetic disease, Mother. It comes from the family. Once you have this, you can never get better. It's not something you just choose. It's sort of like having diabetes, you know. You didn't just go one day, oh, I think I'll eat a lot of sugar and have diabetes. You know, it's not that way. And so I kept explaining this to her, and I'd done it many, many times. And so this was another day where she looked at me, and she goes, okay, honey. So I came back, and I was sitting talking to her the next day. And she said, I think I understand now. And I said, really, Mom? She said, it comes from your father's side of the family. She was happy. And she's just a wonderful woman. I'm living with her again now, and we have so much fun together. Anyway, so I went to this treatment facility. I remember I was supposed to walk into a door. They said there was an AA meeting in there, and I stood there for a moment. It looked like almost like the door was backlit, and I just looked at it, and all of a sudden the thing in my head said, well, I thought to myself, if you walk through that door, you're admitting you're an alcoholic. And all of a sudden the thing in my head said, well, get your ass in there, you are. I don't know how your God talks to you, but mine's funny. And that's a voice that stays with me today that I listen for and I follow. And I have tried to nurture it over the years, but it has given me a direction all the time. Most of it pretty lippy. Anyway, probably figures I can hear it that way. Anyway, so I go through this and I go through treatment. I don't remember anything of treatment. I had really done alcohol a little too long and pretty much fried my brains. So I was coming out of treatment. I remember we had a woman counselor and she was very nice and everywhere. And pretty soon, I decided I'd get gorgeous because that's the next thing to do, of course. And so I decided to get gorgeous. So I lost 100 pounds. And dieting has always been a hobby for me. Obviously, it's not a vocation. And so I lost this 100 pounds, and I had my face done, and I looked gorgeous, man. I was gorgeous. And now all the men are around me, ha, 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 ha. And now I say things to them like, well, it's so nice. Oh, you do want to go out with me. How kind. You didn't seem to want to go out with me a year ago. If you didn't want to go out with me when I was fat, why would I want to go out with you when I'm thin? And, So I'm going through all this stuff, and they had steps and the traditions on the wall, you have that in meetings. You do have that here, right? Steps and traditions on the wall. And so I can read. I'm not stupid. So I'm reading them off the wall, and pretty soon I start writing them down, and I'm thinking, well, okay, powerless. Yep, know that one already. can't stop me. I can't do it there. Insane. Yeah, insane. I'm insane. God, yeah. I believe there's a God. Why wouldn't I believe there's a God? I mean, I'm a woman. I've been under somebody's thumb most of my life. So, I was just nuts. And pretty soon I start sponsoring people. God knows what message I was carrying, but I was busy. And I'm going to meetings and I'm everywhere, and I'm about 3.5 years sober and I'm starting to unravel. And Roger's kind father got up one day. There was a speaker meeting, and he got up, Don, and he said, I don't feel like telling my story tonight. He said, I'm going to talk about the history of AA. And everybody kind of went, we're all so eager. And he got up and he started just talking about Sister Ignatia and Father Dowling and Henrietta Seiberle. And I'm thinking, who the heck are all these people? And I had prided myself on knowing everybody in AA at that point. Just a little ego problem. And I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, Cookie, you call yourself a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't even know what you're a member of. You're a hypocrite. It's a bad thing to be in cookie land. Hypocrite's a bad thing in cookie land. So, I went home and I thought, I'm 3.5 years sober. I'm gorgeous. I've done everything to fix myself. Obviously, it's not working. I might as well kill myself. I'm 3.5 years sober, sitting in the middle of 4 meetings a week, dying of the illness of alcoholism. Dying of the illness of alcoholism because nobody's telling me what alcoholism really is. Nobody's giving me a solution that works. We're just all talking about topics, And once in a while, somebody would mention the third step, but there was no, go through the book. There was nothing going on that I saw at that time. And I'm sitting thinking about this. I'm thinking I don't want to shoot myself. I don't want to leave that kind of a mess for anybody. I can't take pills because then I blow my sobriety. And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll start the car. And then I can put on all my makeup. You see my order of importance here. And then I can just sit in the car and I'll go to sleep and I'll die. And then I thought about that for a while. I thought, well, if my car runs that long, I'm going to end up killing my dog. And I just couldn't stand it if I killed my dog. So during the middle of this wonderful musing, I had a little rule for myself. And that was to, whenever you got really, really crazy, which I did frequently, I had a lot of anxiety attacks when I was first sober, and you read something until you calm down. Well, you see, I'm very good on looks, and I have a copy of the big book. It's on the table, so you'll know I'm a member of AA. And then I have the grapevine. Y'all know what the grapevine is, our meeting in print. And I have those fanned out over here, so you'll know I'm a member of AA. I didn't read them. And I got everything again, all the accoutrements of looking like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not a member. I don't even know what AA really is. And so all of a sudden something ran through me. I'm reading this book, and I'm thinking, I got to do something. So I pick up an issue of this grapevine. Who knew? And after reading my self-help book. And I picked up an issue of the grapevine, and I just picked it up, and I opened it like this, and it said, Suicide in Sobriety. I went, not funny. And then there was a reprint of an article that said, there will come a time in your sobriety when there's a piece of your ego dying off because it is no longer necessary and it's trying to take you with it. It took me a number of years to be able to label that after a lot of work. But when I finally did label it, I called it Cookie the Star. You see, I'd been a star in riding and skating and all these things I'd ever done in my life because I was a super achiever. And so when I came into AA and I sobered up, I was going to be an AA star. Any of you tried that? Just do everything everybody tells you to do, and it'll be all fine. And see, my whole value, my whole sense of worth came from you telling me I'm okay. Everything came from that. So I went and did everything everybody said in AA so that you would say I was okay so that I would feel whole. And I ran myself ragged trying to make all you happy. You know, like I said, I was everywhere. I did everything. I volunteered for every position. I did everything you're supposed to do, I thought. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking about that, and all of a sudden this thought goes through my head. You better read the big book like your life depends on it, because it does. That's weird. So I look down at this book I've never opened, and I pick it up, and it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered, not recovering, recovered, from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. I thought, well, that's what it's for. I'm sorry, I'm slow. And so I picked, and I just started reading it, and when it said pray, I prayed, and when it said write, I wrote, and that's what I did, man. I followed the directions exactly. And, you know, I read where it said, you know, nothing so much ensures immunity as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when all other measures fail. And so I'm out there, and I'm starting to collect sponsees, you know, and I'm getting them. I'm saying, hi, you really do want to read the big book with me, don't you? I think you really love the big book. It's really going to be fun. I have one right here who got that. And so that's what I did, and I was on fire. You know, and I wrote off this four-step like it says in the big book, and I wrote out all those columns, and I couldn't think of anybody I resented. Honest to God, couldn't. At that time, Charlie and Joe came through. And I went up to Joe, and I said, Joe, I think I'm not going to make it in this program. And he said, how long have you been sober? And I said, 3.5 years. And he kind of went, okay. And I said, but I can't think of anybody I resent. And he said, put yourself on the head of the resentment list. And that's what I did, and that's where I started. And I put myself on the head of the resentment list because I just hated me. I didn't just not like me. I hated me. And how that worked out for me is I never had a resentment because I was so self-centered, I didn't even bother resenting you. I could just hate myself and have all the fun. And if I hadn't had that key, and so many keys as we go along, people give us keys, you know, keys to our sobriety, new tools, whatever we need. And if I hadn't had that key, I don't know where I'd be today. But that's where I started. And I did that, and I read this to my sponsor. She had no idea what I was doing. She said, that's nice, dear. I'm glad you've been busy. And I adored her, but she wasn't a big book person. And so now I'm collecting all these girls, and we're all going everywhere together, and I take the first two rows of every single meeting, and we all go sit in line. And it's me and all the girls, and we're big book people. We're doing big book. We all do it together. We're like a cadre of rabid big book women. And so, it was really funny because I shared with the girls that I had waited a year and a half before I had any relationships in AA. And, well, that's because the old-timers said 2 years and the newer people said 1 year, so I split the difference. And so I'm doing all this, and so I'm suggesting this to my girls. Well, now I happen to sponsor all the most beautiful girls in AA. So pretty soon now I'm getting men who hate me because they can't touch my AA women until they've got a year and a half. So I didn't impose this rule. It just happened because I tell people, you know, that's what I did. You can choose to do what you want to do. And so now I'm getting people coming up to me telling me how much they resent me. And I always figure that's good because they got to pray for me. And all these places I'm going, priest, and I hear this thing for the jungle drums. They say, yeah, Cookie's got all the sponsees. Who the hell does she think she is? You know, Cookie and her crumbs. So, of course, my girls being my girls, they all came in going, I'm Cookie's crumb. But anyway, it was a wonderful and exciting time. It was an exciting time. You know, we're doing our work together. We're making amends. We're doing all that stuff, you know. And when I wrote out my fifth step and when I looked at my character defects the first time, I didn't know much about it. But this time it's starting to eat on me. Now I'm 7-8 years sober and it's starting to eat me up a little bit, you know. I'm doing all this fun stuff and I've gone as far as I could go alone, truthfully. I'm having these girls go through the book with me. They're going along. They're doing well. And all of a sudden I start kind of unraveling again. And I unravel enough that I do some things that are very embarrassing for me in sobriety. And it's acting out behavior. And I ended up fooling around with a guy I shouldn't have been fooling around with. And it was very embarrassing. It was very embarrassing for me. I think there's a lot of surrenders in sobriety. I think we go through a lot of them. And I think our first big surrender is coming in, and then we start to peel away all, like they talk about the layers of the onion. We start to peel things away, and we start to become the people we're supposed to become, the people that God wants us to be. And in that process is amazingly painful at times. And so what I realized at that time was I just couldn't go on doing this by myself alone. And I was asking God, and I'd kind of gotten away from really asking God much. You know how that works. And, you know, you get busy. I'm too busy to pray. That'll work well, Cookie. And anyway, so I asked God. I said, I don't know what to do anymore. And the ego had reasserted itself, as it will do. And I'm sitting in my meeting one day, and in comes this lady. Never seen her before. And she sits down, and she ends up being in my group, and she sits down, and she has her big book with her. And I thought, shazam. I had been bringing my big book into meetings, and they said things to me like, are you going to read out of that GD book again? You know, so I've always been a people pleaser, so I just started memorizing paragraphs. I'm naughty. And so I would just say paragraphs when I was in meetings. And she came in, and she knew all about the book. She had 10 more years of sobriety almost than I did. And that woman saved my life. And I'm always hoping that for any of you that don't know that there's a big book and there is a way out and that you don't ever have to drink again, that there is someone that can help you and that you can get through this and you're never alone. You're never alone no matter what. You can choose to be alone, but you're never alone. You can choose to use again, but you're never going to have to if you don't want to, because there's enough of us that care enough that will carry the message and help you. It's almost like a rebirth, you know, in a sense. And we went and we did a lot of stuff together. I went through the whole book again with her. And I had a whole new reawakening and a whole new purpose for my life. And I was just, it was fabulous. I was doing well. Everything was going well. My business was well. And I had been asking God, you know, I don't know what to do. I do have a lot of things wrong with my body. I was getting older. I knew I couldn't keep working the way I was working. And so I asked God to give me some kind of a sign for what I needed to do. And you know how that works. I was tired of being alone. A friend of the family's had been in AA for a long time. And he ended up being a speaker at one of the meetings I was at. He gave the worst AA talk I've ever heard in my life. And all my friends are looking at him going, huh? And anyway, so I went to talk to him afterwards, and I said, well, gee, where did you learn that the 12 steps were developed by a minister in Florida? And I had a little different opinion than that. Anyway, we had shown horses together for 40 years ago, and I had known his family. He'd known my family. He was an older gentleman. I knew that I needed some financial security, and I was real tired of being alone, and I made a lot of compromises and ended up marrying him. And that was very interesting. Shortly before I married him, I was out rollerblading one day. I turned 50, and I was out rollerblading one day, and I didn't see this car coming, and she hit me. And I broke both shoulders and 3 ribs, and that was the start of a wonderful journey that I've had in the last couple of years. My father got cancer. I adore my father. He's always been my hero. And my father got cancer, and he got to die one day at a time while I watched him for a year. And this is, I'm the little girl that would run away from everything. I'm the one that, if there was an emotion anywhere, I'd be somewhere else. If there was any kind of responsibility that really had to do with anything that was emotional, I'd be somewhere else. And I'm the one suiting up and showing up. And I'm doing that because you taught me how to be a person who suits up and shows up. And I'm adoring my father, and I'm watching him shrivel away. And I looked at him one day, and I said, Daddy, I always wanted to ask you this. I said, why did you come on that day when so long ago? And he said that was the day that, you know, he came to the door on my suicide attempt. And he said, I don't know, honey. I was reading the Bible this morning. My father's a very spiritual man. He wasn't very religious, but he was spiritual. And he said, I was reading the Bible that morning, and I knew if I didn't go get you right then, I'd never see you again. You know, so I owe my father my life twice. 2.5 years ago, I was going out to New York to do a talk, and I was sitting on the plane. I was going like this, and I felt a little lump right here. And I got in to see one of my sponsees, Ava, and she looked at it, and she went crazy. She said, you got to call your doctor. You got to call your doctor. And so, and she made me call right then. She's a little over-demanding at times. Anyway, I wouldn't have seen him because I've been through so many doctors with my back over the years. I didn't want to see anybody. But I called my doctor, and she saved my life. I went to the doctor, and I found out that I had stage 4 squamous cell carcinoma of the left tonsil. I went to Mayo on a Friday. They said I had to come in Monday for my surgery. I had a 50-50 chance of surviving the surgery. And if I survived the surgery, I had a 50% chance of ever being able to speak again, turn my head, or lift my left arm. So I went home to get my things in order. I went down there with an Al-Anon sponsee, or an Al-Anon sister sponsor, whatever. And we both had the same sponsor, and she took me down to Mayo because she was familiar with Mayo, and she also was somebody that walked me through this time of my life. I want to know what you're a part of. I want you to know what you're a part of. And maybe you don't know some of this because maybe these things haven't happened to you, but things have happened to me that have been incredibly bad for the last 5 years, and they've been embarrassing and heartbreaking and everything you can think of. During this time that I was having this, my husband decided he wanted to get a divorce. It was very public, and it was very embarrassing for me, and it was a very large betrayal, and it was very hard. And I'm asking God, what am I supposed to be doing here, God? What am I not doing? What am I supposed to be doing? And I don't believe at any one of these times that it was God's idea that I should have to go through things bad. I think life happens. I think life happens, and I think God gives us the ability to handle those things with the friends that we have. So I went for the surgery. I came back Friday, told my mom where everything was, and I looked at my sister, Al-Anon sponsee, and I said, I want to go to the meeting. Because alcoholics go to meetings, and I'm an alcoholic. And I called one of my sponsees, and I said, if you can be there and you can show up and not cry and not fall apart in front of me, I want you to be there. If you can't, please don't come, because I can't handle your emotions and mine too. And so I'm walking this way alone, but I'm not alone, am I? And I sat there in the meeting, and my friends, Keith, other people were there, and, you know, my Al-Anon sponsor and her husband, Bob B., and Linda, and these are people that I love and I've known my whole sobriety, and I don't remember anything anybody said, but I remembered one thing, that they loved me. You know, so I went in for that surgery the next Monday morning, and now, that night before I said a prayer, and I don't know what you know about yourself, but sometimes we learn things about ourselves when it's very, very difficult. And we'd gone out for dinner and they had wine. You know, isn't that just about typical? You know, I go out to dinner with 2 Al-Anons. They have wine. It's the last night of mine on earth, maybe, and they're drinking. What? What? I think it was a ha-ha. Anyway, so yeah, they're drinking and getting silly. They're not drunks, you know, and I'm looking at them like, going, you're getting silly. Am I going to have to drive back to the hotel? And it was very funny. And then they wanted, you know, if I wanted to watch TV with them while they're both giggling. And I said, no, I think I'll pass. And I went and I sat down and I decided to say my prayers. And you know, it was funny because I didn't know I was going to pray this. And I learned a lot about you and about me. And I said, God, you know, I came in here at that time. It was 18 years ago. And I said, I came in on a suicide attempt. So this life has really been your life. And this has been your gift, and hopefully I've been able to give some of it back. hopefully I've been able to love some of your kids and carry your message and tell other people they don't ever have to live the way they used to live, and there is a way out. And if you want me to come home, I've lived my whole life in sobriety and pain, and if you want me to come home, I'm ready to come home. And if you don't, I'll stay and love some more of your kids and carry your message. I went in for surgery the next morning, and I came out 7.5 hours later. And everybody was in the room. There's a whole lot of people in the room, and they were all waiting to see if I could talk, because the doctor didn't know if I could talk either. They didn't know how much was left. They took out most of my neck and jugular vein and the whole back of my throat and like that. So I looked up, and when I looked up, you know, I'd called myself Cookie the Star. That was the piece of ego that had died off at that one time. When I opened my eyes and I looked across the way, and there was a building with a gigantic star on it. And I knew, and I just knew, you know. And I said, "Star." And they went, "She can talk." And they all left. But I want to tell you what you're a part of. I went home after that. I had to go through horrendous radiation. It was very bad. And I had people that loved me so much that they put together an entire color-coded program of who was going to come and pick me up, who was going to be with me 24 hours a day for the next 3 months. Because they knew how bad it was going to be. I had somebody all the time with me. And it was really strange because I was so very sick when I first got done. And I couldn't eat anything and I couldn't swallow anything. And it was really scary. And I thought I was going to choke to death all the time. And it was not fun. Anyway, so I was sleeping and they're giving me lots of things so I sleep. And every once in a while I'd open my eyes and there'd be this cheerful face of someone who's like, "Hi, my name's Chelsea and I'm your great-great-great-grandsponsee. And it's an honor to be here with you." "Hi, Chelsea." But that's what you did. You loved me back to health, and that's what we're a part of. We're a fellowship. We're people that care about each other. And the funny thing is that the people that showed up to care about me, if I would have told you who I thought the top 20 people would be, none of those were the ones that turned up. There were people I hired that heard me speak one time, or that I was did a workshop for them or whatever. And one guy showed up, and he stayed with me every Tuesday night because he'd had cancer before, and I'd lined him up with somebody to take him through the big book. You know, and that's what happens. That's what happens here. You know, we love each other, you know, and I'm the luckiest woman in the world. I am the luckiest woman in the world because I get to come here and love you for a while, you know, and you're very kind to listen to me and you're very kind to be part of my world, you know, and I'm honored to be here at your 60th anniversary. I am honored. I can't begin to tell you. So I will close with my favorite prayer. It's one from Merton. And it says, "I have no idea where I am going. I do not know the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will all end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does, in fact, please you, and I hope that I have that desire in all that I'm doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always. Though I may seem to be lost and in the valley of the shadow of death, I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. God bless you, and thank you for my life."